I'm Darren Levy, and this is Citywide, airing every Tuesday evening from 7:30 to 8 p.m. right here on WNYU 89.1 FM New York and WNYU.org New York University Radio. Citywide features insight from some of New York's most innovative artists. In honor of Best of Week here on WNYU, this episode of Citywide will feature some of the best excerpts from just a few of the interviews from 2006. To start things off, we have Justin Dyke, who is a professional Flash animator. And as we'll hear, sometimes working from home on your computer isn't as easy as it sounds. What's the most difficult part about being a Flash animator?
Well, I guess it's mostly just kind of where you're going to find work with it. And obviously you have, you know, quite a few routes there. You can go and you can look for a Flash animation studio, which there's not a ton of those. There's more web development studios. So, you know, any, even here in, like, kind of small-town Athens, Georgia, there's, you can walk down the street, you can find a web development place. So, you know, you can roll in there and you can kind of show off, hey, look, I have some character animation, but I can also do, like, regular Flash animation, just bringing in text and things like that. So you can go that route, or, obviously, anybody can try to just, you know, sling animation work from home.
Well, I see you have a whole section of audio tips on your website. Would you be able to share some of those for our listeners?
Oh, yeah. That website is it's basementcollege.com. So, of course, there's just hours worth up there. But you know what? Best tips, I think you got to be just kind of creative with getting yourself out there. If you are going to try to freelance from home, you know, it's not the easiest thing in the world, and you don't always have, a big advertising budget. You know, not everybody can sink money into Google because there's a lot of people doing it. So, you know, to pay a dollar a click or whatever, it can get kind of pricey. So, yeah, you got to think outside of the box a little bit. One thing I noticed recently was that, you know, if you're driving around, you will see, you know, the plumber is driving around in a truck that says plumber on the side, but you rarely see anybody driving around that says web developer on the side of it. And of course people are going, oh, I want my car to, you know, have a big thing on it, but you know, it can just be a bumper sticker or something like that that gets you out there over there on that level. I think even just if you're a graphic designer, just tell people, you know, just put it on, you know, the back of your car, I'm a graphic designer, I can draw. And I mean, it sounds kind of cheesy, but you know, if you look at, on the streets, everybody's wearing a T-shirt with an advertisement that's usually not advertising themselves. So you know, I kind of feel like if I'm going to wear anything with a logo on it, it's going to be about me. It's going to, you know, and it doesn't have to be, I don't know, Justin's web development. It could be a drawing that I've done that I think looks cool, so I'll pop it on a shirt. If somebody comments on it, well, there you go. That's kind of your in for saying, yeah, you know what? Actually, I'm an illustrator.
Yeah, right. Does Tommy Hilfiger wear a shirt that has my name on it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know what? It's the basketball players that always kind of like, you'll see a guy wearing like a Shaq shirt. You just go on, like, come on, Shaquille doesn't need you wearing that, you know?
Well, that's definitely a great tip. And I know that you went to school here in New York. How has New York helped you as an artist?
Oh, how has New York helped me? Well, I definitely don't feel like I'd be doing what I'm doing today if I hadn't gone to the School of Visual Arts. Big plug for them. And I mean, I can't say it's like all the school, but it's the surroundings around the school. It's the New York wrapper of that environment. And, you know, it's just like it's the people you meet. It's, you know, it's the cosmopolitan. And you know what, it's weird to say, like, oh, yeah, you got to be crazy all those 4 years to find a job, because really what ends up happening is it's always some little weird thing that comes along where you get that, you know, that job, like the friend of mine that said, hey, yeah, there's some work over here. But you know what, I mean, if I was living here, if I'd gone to school, like, say, the University of Georgia or something like that, I don't know if any of the same opportunities would have necessarily opened up. And this is an awesome town. I love it. Big props to the school. It's a great school. But, you know, there's up in New York, there's actual animation studios. There's all these different companies. And certainly, if you're a Flash animator, you can go to a lot of different places. I mean, you can almost walk into any company and be like, hey, look, here's, I can make all your Excel or PowerPoint presentations a billion times better. They're going to go, oh, yeah, you're hired. So it's New York's got that hustle and bustle. It's I was living 23rd Street, and it just, the street never shuts up, but in a good way. You kind of are always aware that, like, yeah, there's activity out there. So, you know, don't sleep in. You know, get out there and do something.
You ever come back to visit?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I got relatives up there, so I'm up twice a year, definitely.
Well, one thing that I found really interesting on your website was that you said sometimes you'll have a problem, and you'll go and fix the problem, and then while you're fixing it, you'll learn things you didn't even think you would. Do you find that to be a common thing?
Oh, you know what? It's got to happen at least in every tutorial once, where just something goes wrong, and you know what? That's usually the best part about the lesson, because, you know, when the lesson stops and people start doing it on their own, they're going to make that same mistake, whatever it is. So to watch me kind of, like, sidetrack and go, oh, no, you know, and I screwed up the code over here, or I don't like how that eye looks or whatever, so I'm just going to go back 10 steps. Yeah, people learn more by their mistakes than just by, like, the straight shot through the lesson. So, yeah, I don't edit anything out. And it's, you know, if it's an hour-long lesson, that's, you know, that's just me on screen for that hour. And we just take a ride and see where it goes. Occasionally, I guess I'll take, you know, I've messed up a few lessons where I've just had to flat out stop it because I couldn't figure out what I had done wrong. So there's times where, you know, that does occur. But, you know, for the most part, I do. I like it when craziness happens, and especially with the illustration and animation tutorials, because within that, it's not as bad if, you know, at least with the ones where you're doing, like, scripting and coding. And it's kind of annoying if, like, oh, your teacher doesn't really know, like, how to do this. But, you know, illustration's something that there's no playbook for it. So if you just kind of, like, don't like how something looks, well, yeah, fix it right there. Do it for people to see. Throw it out there.
Let's move on and talk a little bit about your comic strip. Could you tell us about The Mouse?
Sure. Oh, and you pronounced it correctly. That's really cool. Even my parents still have problems sometimes. They'll say The Mouse. The Mouse just kind of comes from the sound a cat makes, meow, but you just take out the E part. And we have one cat that just kind of makes that noise, meow, like that. So that's how it started. And you know what? I just started drawing a few years back just because I love my cats. And I was like, all right, these are kind of fun. I got some free time today. And it was like one of those just moments where that light beam came down from the sky, and I just drew three excellent drawings, and I just kind of, like, let them sit on my desktop. I put them on the desktop background, and they stayed there for about a year before I actually did anything other than just, you know, the one illustration of it. And I just, and you know, when you live with cats, you get inside their brain. You just start sort of thinking, like, hey, why did you mess with my tail, you know? And you kind of, like, have this whole dialogue going along for them, even though they're so brain dead, like, 90% of the time. But so it's fun to kind of just imagine, yeah, this is their world. And you know what? What I try to do in the comic strip is have them exist in a very kind of strict cat world where, you know, they don't know anything about politics. They don't know anything beyond the yard that is their turf. And within that kind of microcosm are the weird sort of, you know, what do they think the door flap that they go in and out of actually is? Because they probably don't read it as a door flap. It's some sort of head-banging thing, that annoyance or whatever, a scruff cleaner. So it just kind of puts a little twist on the cat world.
That was Flash animator Justin Dyke. Next up is painter Sharon Appel. As we learn, she has a very effective process for creating her art. How do you work? How do you start and finish a piece?
Let's see, the nuts and bolts. I start with an idea, the idea of a place, whether I'm actually there working on location or working from photographs. So I start with this idea, and then I start putting color down on the paper in a way that somehow effectuates the idea. The first thing I do when I get to a beach, for example, is I size up the view from different spots. I'll just walk around and sort of cut my hands over my eye and try and figure out what, from which vantage point I'll get the most dramatic view with the most dramatic contrast. Because that's what I like to paint. I like contrast, and that's why I like the South Seas and anything Pacific, really, with mountains, gigantic mountains jutting out of the water. So the first thing I do is pick a dramatic view, and then I frame it compositionally, almost as though I were taking a photo of it. And then I do a basic outline of the scene on paper, and that's the scariest part. You're sitting there with a blank paper, nothing on it, but you have this feeling of terrible excitement, like, this view is so beautiful, how can I get it from my head onto the paper? So what I do is just focus very intently on what I'm looking at, and I see it kind of through a lens of abstraction, and it starts to seem like a very simple puzzle piece with maybe four or five pieces. The sea, the sand, the sky, maybe a range of giant mountains jutting out of the water. And I view each element of that landscape as an independent being in its own right, and then I proceed to animate each element, because each element is, to me, alive. So the question for me becomes, how does it feel to be that coastline? How does it feel to be that wave? And I ask these questions as I take in the sights around me and as I attempt to portray on paper whatever it is that I see. And again, it's always through this very subjective lens. It's not like I'm trying to do some photographic representation. And once I get the outline down on paper, and it can be a very rough outline, but it's just an outline of the basic elements of the composition, then I sort of breathe a sigh of relief because I've got the basic components of the scene down. And I usually work in pastel. That's my primary medium. And I work in complementary colors. So I'll start with the opposite of what I intend to end up with. So if I want to end up with a lot of blues and greens, my first layer on the paper will be a lot of oranges and reds. So that's sort of it. I just kind of keep going layer by layer by layer, and I don't really try to rush.
Where did you learn to do all that? Did you just figure it out, or did you take classes on that?
I studied at an art school, at a tiny little art school, and then actually I went off to the South Seas, and I just started working on location, and at a certain point, everything just started clicking. It was just amazing. It's like out of a novel or something. It's like I was on this really remote beach on this really remote island, and from one painting to the next, there was just this quantum leap forward. I suddenly began to understand how to work with the pastels and how to get this amazing color and how to get on the paper the drama that I was feeling inside me by just beholding these amazing sights and being in these amazing places. So it was kind of a magical process. And then when I got back from the trip, I started studying privately with a teacher. And we sort of focused on complementary colors. But actually, we'd been doing that before I went away. The person I studied with is Tad Spurgeon. And in the classes that he taught, he spoke about complementary colors. So I'd already been working with that before I went away.
I know you drew a painting of the World Trade Center. Would you like to talk about that?
Right. Yeah, that painting is actually, I titled that painting Our Friends, the Twin Towers. So that painting arose out of the events of September 11th, 2001, and my reaction to it, to those events. I started working on a painting of the Brooklyn Bridge and the World Trade Center, which is the image depicted in the painting, as a way of sort of channeling my sadness and outrage over the events toward a positive end. So kind of in keeping with that positive spirit, I called it Our Friends, the Twin Towers. I'm from New York City originally, and for me, the attack on the Trade Center was an attack on all of New York City and my hometown, and what in my view is one of the most tolerant places in the world. Also, I feel that New York City has been such a refuge and held out so much hope for so many people from so many backgrounds. So many people have come to New York with nothing and transformed their lives. And I felt that it was so outrageous and cruel that anyone would attack that, that anyone would just try to blow it all up. And my feeling was that despite the barbarism and depravity of these attacks, that nothing could shake the spirit of New York City and the people of New York. Nothing could destroy the promise of hope that the city has historically held out. So I started working on the painting. The Brooklyn Bridge is symbolic of the hope and opportunity and the welcoming or at least tolerance of immigrants that the city has always embodied. And Brooklyn, because that's where I'm from. And I left the towers standing as a tribute to them and a tribute to those who perished and those who sought to save people. And as a symbol of the fact that nothing can destroy the spirit of the people of New York. They rise above it. They rise above the barbarian acts of their attackers. Nothing can corrupt the generous spirit of the people of New York City. And I think the mood's sort of nostalgic and wistful and as if through a dream, because that's how my work is generally, and that's just how it came out. I hadn't consciously set out to do that. So that's where the painting comes from. It was sort of my companion for many, many months after the events, and you know, it was sort of like my place of refuge from the horror.
That was painter Sharon Appel. Suzanne Feel is the artistic director of the Issue Project Room. This is an experimental art space that puts on many unique performances every month, and sometimes it can be difficult to maintain such a venue. As an artistic director, do you have any tips for someone who wants to start their own art space?
You have to be crazy to start an art space in this world that we're living in now. You know, we're a non-for-profit space, so you know we have to be very passionate about what we're doing, otherwise we would never be able to do this. Money is a very difficult thing these days, as I'm sure you know and everybody knows. There's no real government money for the arts, so you have to get very creative and figure out how to work that and how to find money to keep yourself alive. When you're a nonprofit, you're really not eligible for most foundation and government funding until you've made it for 3 years. So making it to 3 years is a trick, and I really feel like there is a certain magician quality that you have to possess. And my staff, we're all a bunch of little magicians just trying to keep it happening, but you know, we just keep the faith that we're doing what we're doing and doors are opening and we must be on the right track. But you have to get very creative. You really have to figure out ways to find money, to find support, to bring in your community, to bring in your artist community, but also to bring in the community that appreciates the arts. And that's all happening. We have a very passionate community that comes here, and people who come here really appreciate, you know, what we're doing. It's very special, but it's, you know, it's very different. You know, our culture should completely support the artists that we're representing and the work that we're trying to do. Larger institutions should be supporting us, individuals who believe in the arts as something of power and beauty and the power of expression should really step up to the plate. It's a time when, because the government isn't supporting culture right now, it's really a time when individuals need to step up to the plate and support culture. Artists who've made it, you know, there's a lot of artists who come from experimental world who should really, like, look at the work that we're doing in other spaces like us and step forward and say, what can I do to help you? You know, it's like, we've come up with some interesting ideas that we're trying to implement in the future. there's a woman who we met a few weeks ago who runs a wonderful management company, and she works in Tennessee, but she works with a lot of artists in New York and Europe. Her name is Regina Green, and she's with Eclipse and is also affiliated with Table of the Elements label, which is a label of musicians and artists who make music. And, you know, coming up with new ways of getting people to support us, like, well, here's a big idea. Like, if a band like Pearl Jam gave us 50 cents off every concert ticket, that would really help, things like that. Getting artists to, you know, Steve Buscemi is on our board of directors, and he comes from the East Village, and he worked his way up through the experimental art community. So when he learned about our space, he just couldn't help but be supportive because he so appreciates what we're doing, and he's done a lot to help our organization. So that's kind of what I'm talking about, somebody who understands the work that we're doing and what it takes deliver that, and comes in and says, you know, hey, if it wasn't for places like you, I wouldn't be where I am today, so what can I do? And there's a lot of people out there who could really be coming towards us, and we hope to bring them in. We really feel strongly about our mission. This is the kind of work that pushes culture forward, and without spaces like this, you know, which we kind of feel like we're a breeding ground to create new work, new languages, new ways of seeing, new ways of hearing. And this isn't always the work that is going to make the big bucks. You know, like Missy Elliott didn't start out here. but a lot of her ideas are stemmed and steeped from experimental ideas. Like, you know, that little pause that she makes that she sort of brought to the foreground in commercial music. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you have to think about John Cage or Thelonious Monk or artists before her who really, you know, took that and utilized it in their work, and now she's capitalizing on it. But, and we love her, and she's great, and these, you know, this is like sort of a thread where, like, these ideas were thought about and practiced 30 years ago or more, and it takes about that long of a timeline before experimental ideas find their way to mass culture. And that's why we feel very devoted to supporting the artists who are working to create those new languages. And this is what keeps culture alive. This is what keeps culture moving forward. So it's very important to us. And, you know, being American, we don't want our country to fall off and lose its cultural edge, which it kind of is doing right now. And so in a lot of ways, we feel like we're becoming, not that we ask to be, but we're becoming cultural activists. Because if we don't do it, it won't get done. So somebody's got to do it, and there's a bunch of us out there. There's, you know, a lot of wonderful spaces in New York who are concerned with this and who are working to keep this kind of art alive so that art can keep moving.
Cultural activist is a very honorable title to give yourself there.
It's not something I ever thought I would be a part of, but I guess, you know, it's what needs to be done, so we're doing it.
That was Susan Feel. Lastly, Stan Richardson is a playwright and a play critic. He's definitely immersed himself in the New York theater world. I read your bio, and I see you're also a reviewer for nytheater.com. So do you think that it's hard to critique plays when you know how much hard work goes into putting them together?
Yes. Well, it is, but Martin Denton, who is the editor and the founder of nytheater.com and the New York Theater Experience, when I started writing for them, his philosophy behind reviewing really changed the way I saw the role certainly of the reviewer and of the critic. I mean, Martin says that these people, generally speaking, did not put up this play to annoy you specifically. And I think that's something that I needed to hear at that time, maybe, you know, a few years ago. And it's something I think important to remember that. As I go into seeing a play, it's a much more interesting question, I think, to ask. It's much more interesting, I think, for a reader to, for the reviewer to actually ask, well, why was this not successful if it was not successful? And not like, not attacking the play as much as just asking it questions and trying to understand why was this written today, or why is this being revived right now? What is the need behind it? Being more curious than critical. I think that's a lot of what I have learned from writing for NYTheater.com. I feel like that that spirit is in all of the reviews, and I love reading the site for that reason. I feel like I'm getting a, you know, there's a generosity of spirit there, as well as like sharp critical thinking, and the combination of those I find to be so much more affirming, certainly more palatable than a lot of other critics and their mediums.
Clearly you're a part of the New York theater scene. What has New York done for you as an artist?
I can't really imagine living anywhere else. I mean, it seemed like home. It really did seem like home before I had ever been here. I like it. There's a certain part of me that likes the very limited amount of space that I have in my apartment, because it forces me to go out in the world and interact. I come from St. Louis, in the Midwest. There are a lot of cars there. People spend a great deal of time in their cars in these little pods. I'm referring to the cars as pods, but they've got some new technology where people sit in pods in their cars. But there's such a great disconnect there. I mean, I know that people in New York do experience a kind of urban isolation. You know, another 100 people. There's so many strangers. It's rare in some ways that you'll see the same person twice ever, unless you don't want to run into them, in which case you'll see them regularly. But I find actually a profound sense of connection, of just being. I think once I started to become comfortable with being one of many, with a certain kind of anonymity, which is hard to do because I think everybody wants to. Well, I'll speak for myself. I don't know everybody all that well, but I for a long time, you know, being there in the Midwest, I did like struggle to be special, to feel. I mean, I think it had in some ways to do with growing up gay. I think it had to do with other perhaps familial circumstances. But I really, you know, kept thinking about like struggling to distinguish myself, to get out, and whereas here it's like I wake up every day and I'm thrilled and thankful to be living here in New York. I mean, really, I'm living here in New York. I'm supporting myself, and I have these wonderful actors who are, you know, doing my plays a few times a week, and that is all I've ever wanted. So I'm not sure how that addresses New York. How does that address New York? Well, yes, that I am thrilled to be in New York. I take the same walk to work every morning. I work at a law firm, which that's my real passion. As being a legal secretary, the writing the plays, that's you know, what I do for money. But I take the same way to work every morning, and it's different every time. I hope that's what like a romantic like a long term romantic relationship will be like too. Like just the you know, this familiarity, that something so familiar that all of a sudden you break into this world where it's constantly seeing new things there.
That's it for Citywide. I'm Darren Levy. You can find out more about all the guests featured on tonight's show, as well as every guest who has been heard on Citywide, on the website, wnyu.org/citywide. Feel free to email your questions and comments to citywide@wnyu.org. We'll be back next week with more Arts Talk, but for now, keep it here on New York University Radio as Best of Week continues with experimental acoustic music with Heather on Outside. Thanks so much for tuning in, and from everyone here at WNYU News, have a great night.